als sie Stunden später aus ihrer Bewusstlosigkeit erwachte.
Blut an die Hände, Ebbes Hände, Blut an die Hände.
Musik längst verklungen ist, ärgert sie sich. Am Set warten die anderen immer noch. Stellen ihre Arbeitgeber sie nach solchen Tagen zur Rede, hüllt sie sich in Schweigen. Wortlos abgewandt, starrt sie zuerst überzeugend attraktive Dinge an. Ab einem bestimmten Punkt heften sich ihre Augen mit der Kraft von Saugnäpfen an die nackte Wand und verharren dort. Wer sie in solchen Momenten sieht, glaubt, sie hätte in den ruhevoll lächelnden Mustern der Tapete etwas noch nie Gesehenes entdeckt. Mag ihr allein das wiederkehrende Starren den Ruf der Haltlosigkeit einbringen, verkörpert sie auf der Leinwand. We'll be right back.
Come and not up it, boy. With that, you have nothing about me.
How will your style as not up it, boy? I'm a little boy, you know.
You're charged for possession of ganja.
What? You think I'm on a battery? What is what you're talking about, boy?
Yes, I'm not
about it. Your backside, eh? Sure.
I'm a Nazi.
Internationally.
Not a dreadlocks.
All over the world.
I'm a Rastaman.
Sons and daughters of Jah.
Not a dreadlocks.
Not a dread. When I see the morning sun, and I told all day till my day was done, 'cause I shall never run before my work is done, oh Jah. 'Cause I got to have some fun, you got to tell it to the sun. Before you know it, I'll be gone. Rastaman, get it on. Not to dread loss, I tell ya. Be humble and be true in the sight of the Almighty Jah Rastafari. Was mercy enduring forever, he lived and he shall never die. You can make it if you try. Naughty, naughty.
Not a dreadlocks.
Kind of that to me and you are twa.
I'm a Rastaman.
Unite to withstand the battle before.
Not a dreadlocks.
I can't be down beyond the wall. Sons and daughters of Jah, we still know. Because of the 6 days God created this great heaven and earth, and the 7 day rested. That's why man and man must meditate and let his thoughts be manifested. 'Cause in a time of fight, did Jah win and earth begun? He comes to bring down prisoners and the captives free. Come to rule, not to dread, for justice and equality. Selassie, I am man, I demon, and strength. Man and man should try down the road and go back to Ethiopia one of these days. Where I man come from, our forefathers' land. Down in Saskatchewan, I'm a dreadlocks. Naughty, naughty dreadlocks to tell you all over the world. Take off that shoe from off the feet, for the place where those standards is holy ground. Now take it and listen to the sound. I tell you this, you're young, I'm a dreadlocks. I officially a naughty dreadlocks. Coming from the rocks, so please give my chance, I'm a dreadlocks. I took dread, I took dread, I took, not of dreadlocks. Dressed in blacks, coming from the rocks. Gonna tell you the facts. Gonna go on with the income tax. I tell you, got to relax. I give you the facts. I'm a dreadlocks.
I'm a
I'm not a dreadlocks. rascal drinking drugs.
Over Caracas, that fabulous city founded on the vast revenue from Venezuela's oil deposits. It's the morning after a revolution in which a would-be dictator, General Jimenez, was deposed at the cost of some 300 lives. And now the capital rejoices over its hard-won freedom. But trouble is not yet over. Political feeling and the desire for vengeance is still running high. When a police state regime is overthrown in a South American country, rioting inevitably follows. As violence increased, the police were ordered to their barracks, and the army and the National Guard took over the task of restoring order. Presently, crowds gathered outside the Miraflores Palace, where the new ruling junta was being sworn in. It was headed by Rear Admiral Wolfgang Larrazabal in white. After he and his ministers had officially taken office, he broadcast to the people. And calm once more settled over Caracas.
Thank you. Bye. Hello, I'm Steve Rosenberg, the BBC's Russia editor, and this is The Interview from the BBC World Service. The best conversations coming out of the BBC. People shaping our world from all over the world.
Today we are spending trillions on war and peanuts on peace.
Wind power in the United States has been subsidized for 33 years. Isn't that enough? Solar for 25 years. That's enough.
I don't have army. I don't have missile rockets. I have my body. I have my voice.
I love singing, and so my goal was always to do better and better at it.
I was still in an induced coma in hospital when the world was defining me.
For this interview, I met Nigel Casey, the UK's ambassador to the Russian Federation, at the official ambassadorial residence, which is directly opposite the Kremlin, just across the River Moskva. In a wide-ranging conversation, the ambassador describes his life in Moscow over the last 2 years, a period of heightened tension between the UK and Russia following Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. The number of diplomats in the city has been drastically reduced. And for a British ambassador in Moscow, there are daily challenges to deal with. You're going to hear him say that he's followed wherever he goes in Russia, and how, on occasions, his staff face harassment. He sees a key part of his job diffusing potentially dangerous diplomatic misunderstandings with the Russian government. He tells me there's a gap between the anti-British rhetoric you hear in the state media and the genuine curiosity of ordinary Russians about the UK, and how this job is one of the most challenging and important of his career.
There's never been a greater demand for analysis, information, understanding of Russia, what drives Russian decision-making, what we can expect from this country's leadership. I suspect the demand for our work has probably not been higher since the end of the Soviet Union, another great period of huge uncertainty. So that is a large part of my job and why my employer sends me here. Because there is so little other contact at the political level between business groups, the embassies in our two countries really are the main remaining thread on which our relationship hangs. It would be extremely dangerous if we didn't have at least this limited ability to communicate with each other. So that's, again, a core part of our function. And for me, perhaps the most important in the long term is to send a message to Russians that, you know, we're not walking away from this relationship. We've never wanted to have any kind of rupture, and we want a different relationship in the future.
Welcome to The Interview from the BBC World Service with the UK's ambassador to Russia, Nigel Casey.
It is tough, obviously, working here in current circumstances. But it is a bit of history we're living through here. It feels like, from a professional point of view, one of the most important and consequential jobs I could be doing anywhere. It is a strange kind of privilege, if you like, to find myself here in this job in current circumstances. You know, we are every single day, as you know, accused of increasingly outlandish plans and plots by various bits of the Russian state. It taps into a deep wellspring of Russian sense of rivalry, I would say, with Britain. When you actually talk to Russians, as you do, you find it's a much more complex relationship, and people's attitudes are rarely as black and white as they're portrayed in the official media. I actually very rarely encounter any genuine hostility from ordinary Russians. Even when I introduce myself they've acknowledged who I am, you very quickly get past that. I think Russians are fascinated by the UK, and the reverse is also true, of course. And I think there is a degree of respect in that relationship, and I say mutual admiration and interest, which transcends individual governments and individual difficult periods like this in our history.
I agree. There seems to be a big gap between the sort of anti-British rhetoric that you hear in the state media and what ordinary Russians say about Britain. But, you know, this hostility towards the UK from the authorities, how does that affect your work as British ambassador here?
Well, it has obviously made it much more difficult in a practical sense. People are literally scared of meeting us. I have noticed, even in my 2 years here, the number of people who are willing to meet me has shrunk. It was small when I arrived, and now it's smaller. We know that the kind of people that we might have met in earlier times in think tanks, in the academic world, never mind diplomats, have been formally told that they have to report any interactions with unfriendly embassies. And since we're at the top of that list, I think that particularly affects us. So the circle of Russians that one can talk to is smaller, but also the job is narrower. I mean, there are large areas of work which the embassy did when I was last here 20 years ago that we just don't do at the moment. Think cooperation in science, in technology, in climate change, in arts and culture, education. These are things which, you know, in current circumstances are not happening.
How difficult is it to travel around the country? I mean, do diplomats still have the chance to travel around?
Well, it is possible to do a certain amount of official travel. I mean, I've just been in Murmansk, and I was in Archangel earlier this year because we've 2025 was obviously the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, and it was an opportunity to remind people of the contribution of the UK to sustaining the Soviet war effort, because as you know, vital supplies were brought in through the Arctic convoys to northern Russia to sustain the Soviet war effort in the sort of vital first couple of years of the German invasion of Russia. So going to places like that and paying tribute to those who lost their lives in that effort is tolerated. We have a consulate still in Yekaterinburg, which I'm able to visit. I would say if I tried to do an official visit with formal meetings anywhere else, it's pretty much impossible. People won't meet you. It'll be as difficult as possible. Suddenly a demonstration will appear. And so for the rest of Russia, you can do personal travel, but official travel it just doesn't work in current circumstances.
And, I mean, I don't know if you can talk about it or not, but, I mean, when we travel outside of Moscow, very often, not always, but very often we sense there are people sort of following us or keeping an eye on us. Would that be the same for diplomats?
Oh, yes, yeah, no. We assume that by one means or another, people are following our movements and who we're talking to and what we're up to. And, I mean, that has always been the case, though. I mean, you know, one feature of the current landscape, which I think is not new, is this obsession with following foreigners around Russia. But it always, of course, it particularly applies to us and in current circumstances, all the more so. So yes, some of it tips into overt harassment. That's quite rare, but thankfully, but does happen, as you may have seen outside this building when we mark our National Day. There's quite often suddenly a crowd of concerned citizens outside making a lot of noise and trying to intimidate our guests.
Is it dangerous for Russian guests to come into the embassy?
We have people who have been quite frightened by their experience in coming here. We know people have been spoken to afterwards and have found that quite intimidating. And some people's reaction is to dial back on contacts with us, either for a period or completely. And that's deliberate. And I think it's part of a broader effort, unfortunately, by the Russian state at the moment to really try and minimise contact between Russians and Europe. It feels like, to me, a sort of historic reversal of the trends that we saw here in the 1990s and the early 2000s.
Does it feel to you, because it sort of feels to me as if some kind of new Iron Curtain or Berlin Wall is sort of going up, some new barrier between sort of Russia and Europe?
I think there is definitely a conscious and deliberate and systematic effort by the Russian state to reduce contact between Russians and the West. And if you look at the increasing controls of the internet, to make that difficult online as well as physically. Is it total yet? Is it a total wall? No, thankfully not. And part of the reason that we're here is to make clear to ordinary Russians that that's not the kind of relationship we want. The Kremlin might be trying to reduce their contact with us, but that's not our policy. And indeed, it's not the kind of relationship we want with Russia writ large, and that a different type of relationship would be on offer if Russian behaviour outside its borders changed.
Britain obviously has lots of ambassadors around the world. Trying to be objective, I mean, how challenging would you say the job of British ambassador in Moscow is compared to the others?
Well, thankfully, this is not one of the posts that we categorise as a conflict post. But in terms of the relationship with the host government, this is right up there. I mean, this is one of the most challenging. It's certainly the most challenging job I've done in my career. It's what makes it interesting. It's never easy. It wasn't even easy, 20 years ago in better days.
You're listening to The Interview from the BBC World Service. People shaping our world from all over the world. For this episode of The Interview, I'm speaking to Ambassador Nigel Casey, the UK's top diplomat in Russia. We sat down for tea at the ambassadorial residence. It's a majestic building, a plush Moscow mansion. It was built by a sugar tycoon in Tsarist Russia and, rather appropriately, boasts one of the sweetest locations in Moscow. The ambassador's balcony has the most breathtaking view of the Kremlin, which is just across the river. OK, let's return to my conversation with Nigel Casey. How much contact are you able to have with the Russian government, with the Russian authorities?
It's very limited at the moment. Generally, if you see me going into the foreign ministry, you can put a decent bet on it being bad news. That's not because we don't want to have constructive conversations with the Russian government. I think it's actually a pretty vital part of my job to engage and to try and make sure that dangerous misapprehensions or misunderstandings of our role and intentions are defused wherever possible. But it's rare. I think I've seen the relevant deputy foreign minister three times this year.
What's it like when you're sort of summoned to the foreign ministry? What's that experience like?
It varies. If it's a serious conversation, then it can be quite straightforward. If it's a bit of a media circus, then the Foreign Ministry Press Department will arrange for a group of rather familiar-looking journalists to turn up outside the front door, and they'll play all sorts of games trying to make you look stupid on the way in and out. That's part of the sort of rigmarole, really, of that kind of information operation, as they call it here.
What is the hardest thing for you as an ambassador here, as far as your job is concerned?
I think the hardest thing for me is worrying about the pressures on my staff. I think my staff tend to get a harder time quite often than I do directly. They not only get followed around, sometimes they will be harassed and quite a lot of the time they might be separated from their families and feeling quite isolated. And so a lot of the job is about making sure that the team's welfare is looked after. I think my responsibility towards them is probably the thing which keeps me awake at night more than anything else.
Another question that I get asked from time to time is, why are you still there? Western journalists should pull out of Russia in protest. Why do you think it's important for example, British diplomats to remain here? So I've heard people say, just build a big wall, just forget about Russia. What do you think?
Well, first of all, from my employer, the British government, there's never been a greater demand for analysis, information, understanding of Russia, what drives Russian decision making, what we can expect from this country's leadership. I suspect the demand for our work has probably not been higher since the end of the Soviet Union, the great period of huge uncertainty. So that is a large part of my job and why my employer sends me here. Because there is so little other contact at the political level between business groups, the the embassies in our two countries really are the main remaining thread on which our relationship hangs. And I think it would be extremely dangerous if we didn't have at least this limited ability to communicate with each other. So that's, again, a core part of our function. And the third is, as I mentioned earlier, I think, and for me, perhaps the most important in the long term is to send a message to Russians that, you know, we're not walking away from this relationship. We've never wanted to have any kind of rupture, and we want a different relationship in the future. But that does depend on, you know, fundamentally different type of Russian behaviour outside its borders.
And I suppose Russia. I mean, Russia's not going anywhere, is it? And the biggest country in the world.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Russia's. It's a great myth of Russian propaganda that we ignored Russia and forgot about it. You hardly ignored Russia. You've been reporting this story for three decades or more. We never have. It's a compelling story. Russia generates a lot of news, mostly bad, but it's never news that you can ignore. And it matters for our interests, particularly the security and stability of the European continent. And so that's not something we will ever walk away from voluntarily.
Do you get a sense, because very often I get a sense that I'm living in some kind of alternative reality or parallel reality, how difficult is it to sort of live and work in that kind of atmosphere, that kind of landscape where black is white and white is black?
You do live in a parallel universe of Russian propaganda here, and I encourage my team and myself make sure I get out of Russia regularly to remind myself what normal looks like. And because after you've been here for a while, it's very, very hard to ignore this sort of tidal wave of untruth which comes at you 24/7. And you find it starts to seep in, and I understand why Russians start to imbibe some of this stuff when they hear it so constantly. One of my favourite discoveries is that Lewis Carroll visited Russia in 1867. It was the only country he ever visited outside the UK. And some people claim that he wrote Through the Looking Glass as his response to his experience, even in 1867, of this country and quite how different it was. And he talked about seeing the city reflected in a false mirror. I think that there is something that about Russia that has endured for that length of time. But the inoculation against it is to get out regularly and reset, and then come back refreshed and clear about where truth lies.
That's fascinating. I had no idea that Lewis Carroll had been here.
He came here on it was actually an ecumenical visit. He came to visit the Orthodox Church because there was a fad for reuniting the Eastern and Western churches, and he met the Metropolitan of Moscow. And he visited Moscow, St. Petersburg, but also Nizhny Novgorod. So the place obviously made a deep impression. He talked about hearing the jabber of voices, because he obviously couldn't understand Russian. And again, some people claim that the Jabberwocky was his response to hearing such an unfamiliar language spoken around him and not having any idea what it meant.
Fascinating, fascinating. What do you like about Russia? What are the things that attract you to Russia?
Well, Moscow is still in many ways a great city, and one of the things that one can still enjoy despite everything here is the cultural offer that Moscow has. I try as far as possible to take opportunities to go to the theatre, go and see new films, go and listen to the really world-class music that is on offer here every night of the week. There are new openings of exhibitions, even if it's having to use the resources within Russia rather than cooperating with any foreign institutions these days. And I studied history at university, and Russia is steeped in it, and so I find all of that rich and fascinating, and that's what keeps me going here. I'm sure, I imagine you feel the same.
Absolutely, yeah. Just bringing the conversation back to the political situation here. Another question I get asked a lot on air, constantly, is what is Vladimir Putin thinking? You know, what's in his mind? And I expect to an extent that's a question which kind of you're looking at on a daily basis. Is it possible to know? Is it possible to work out his thought processes, his thought patterns, what his plans are? Because I suppose that's kind of the answer to that question is key.
Well, a lot of it is they're hiding in plain sight. I would always recommend to people reading Vladimir Putin's speeches and his public addresses, some of the particularly seminal ones, his famous Munich speech in 2007. If you look at the speech he gave to the foreign ministry in June 2024 about his goals for the war in Ukraine, his famous essay on the historical unity of Ukraine and Russia. A lot of his innermost thinking is on the page. Now, can you take it all at face value? Well, that's a challenge which, you know, I think it requires people who've been here as long as you have to take judgments on. But there is a consistency about President Putin's view of the world and his objectives, which I think you can trace back. Maybe it's easier to do it in retrospect, but you can certainly, sitting where we are today, trace it back to the very early days of his time as president. So, I mean, this is an extremely closed political system, and I think Winston Churchill said something about compared Russian politics to the bulldogs fighting under a carpet, in the sense that it was only after you saw the outcome that you knew you had a sense of what had been going on. But it is, I think that's part of the fascination of my job, and I guess yours, is that we have to assemble a jigsaw puzzle with only a few of the pieces, and fill the rest in with our own experience and knowledge. And I think with Vladimir Putin, there's a lot of clues in public, and some of the other bits you have to fill in for yourself.
Thank you for listening to the interview.
Okay, das ist Darmstadt Radio und eben Löscher. Und heute sprechen wir mit Philipp.
I'm a Nazi.
de hoeren lopen.
Bonjour étranger, d'où viens-tu? Tu m'as l'air bien curieux. Et qu'est-ce qui te fascine donc chez moi? Quelle importance, nous ne nous reverrons jamais. Mais quel est ton nom? Quelle importance, nous ne nous reverrons jamais.
Monsieur, pas de mon sexe, monsieur, t'as
ça va pas, non? Pas de politique. Quelle importance, nous ne nous reverrons jamais. Favori. Où viens-tu, Foutrax? Qui es-tu vraiment? Parlons, Foutrax, nous ne nous reverrons jamais.